Run it up. It's hour number two, transmitting from the White Claw Hard Seltzer Studios at Fox Sports Knoxville. This is really cool what we're about to do. John T. Edge is a friend of mine. I got to catch up with him about his show, True South, its third season, debuting this past week on SEC Network. And if you aren't watching it, this will be a service announcement as to why exactly you should be. It's about the place that we live, the people that live here, the food that kind of connects us all. It's fantastic, and I was really grateful to be given the opportunity to get some of this man's time. We're going to get to the interview right now. Joined by John T. Edge, the director of the Southern Foodways Alliance. He also is part of a fantastic program now airing on SEC Network called True South. Third season just came out this past week. The whole point of the show is telling stories about food and the people who make said food and the experiences said food encourage between communities in the South. John T., I'm really excited to have you on the show today to talk about that. Off the rip here, what was the genesis of creating this thing with yourself and Wright Thompson, who's the executive producer, when you started up back in 2018?
Well, first off, thank you for having me, Peyton, and thanks for that synopsis of the show. You got really close to what we intended. And the show started with Wright and I eating cheeseburgers and crinkle cut fries at a place called Handy Andy in Oxford. And it began with us talking about this idea of, could we really try to get it right, to get the South right? Which is a tall order, because this is a place just wrapped in stereotype, obscured by myth, a place many people have told stories about for a very long time, and that some of those stories that have been told about the South and that we Southerners have told about our place are part of the problem. You know, that the South has lived with for so long. So our goal was really simple and really complex at the same time. Like, can we tell stories about the South using food culture, using two restaurants in one place? Can we set them in conversation with each other? And out of that, can we get some bigger truth? Can we get at some bigger truth about the region, about its people, about its history, and can we look to a future together?
Well, I think you said it there. There is nothing more Southern than simple and complex at the same time. And that was, that complexity was magnified this year. You guys were set to start up in March. That's when the pandemic hit. You had this tour across the South. I think you're going to 8 restaurants in several different cities, and everything changes on a dime. So really, I want to know, how has the message and the mission of the show changed now in this era of COVID-19?
In a way, the COVID intensified what we do. It didn't change it at all. What we do now with higher stakes. Mm. What we do now with greater intent. And as showed in that first episode, as we revisited the 16 restaurants we had profiled in the previous two seasons, like, we realized we built these strong connections with the proprietors of the restaurants, with the cooks, with the bartenders, with this coterie of people about whom we cared. And so in this moment of social division, in this moment of deep and profound anxiety over our communal health, we just went harder at it. And to go harder at it, we had to protect ourselves and those people about whom we were going to tell stories. But if anything, it just made us want to do it with more vigor in this moment. We had to get back out. It was important to us.
So yeah, on that, you know, at the end of that first episode, which is available on ESPN Plus, SEC Network, airing now, you focus on these cities. And this first episode, it says it starts in Oxford, but really it starts, you know, in some lawn chairs in your backyard talking to Wright about what's happened and where we're going now. You talk to all these people from the past, and then you kind of look forward. And there's a commercial break, and then you come back, you shave off your quarantine beard, the heavy guitars kick in. It's like this Avengers uniting moment as you guys get back out onto the road. What told you that now was the time to get back out?
Well, that front porch conversation of which you speak, we did that because, you know, what if we had been going through a period of momentous change and torment in the South or in the nation, you know, we would have gone to a bar to talk it out. Like right now I would have said, okay, let's go meet in a bar. We'll have a couple of drinks. We'll talk about these things that are troubling us. And we couldn't gather in a bar. So the next best thing was we gather on my front porch and we gather 6 feet apart and we gather to worry. And we gather, to project into the future, what we might do when we get to leave the damn porch. and we also take this moment and we use that conceit in a way too. So instead of the bar, we had our front porch. We still had our drinks. And we built our episode around, you know, the two bars where Wright and I drink most often in Oxford, St. Leo and City Grocery. So we tried to use those ideas that, you know, sometimes we need a good bar to talk through our problems. In the absence of a good bar, we gather on the front porch and we talk about the things that trouble us.
Yeah. And that first episode, you, as you said, you talk to Joe Stinchcomb, who is that local bar owner in Oxford. There's a question you asked him that I want to know if you got some more clarity on yourself through your travels here in this third season. Yeah. You ask him, how do you broadcast a smile through a mask? Do you have an answer to that now after you've visited the places that you visited?
I mean, Joe answered my question by saying, you know, I smile through the eyes, and he was flip and playful about it. But it's true. I mean, there is a warmth you can tell by way of the eyes. You can also see cheekbones rise because someone is smiling beneath their masks. There are hand gestures. There's someone who greets your. You walk into the door with their hands like this in a prayerful gesture. There's so many ways in which we communicate, forced in this moment, robbed of our smiles, but our humanity comes through. I mean, it is a sense, you know this, Peyton, I mean, you feel something in the presence of someone who is showing you kindness and care. And you feel it in your bones in a way. And again and again, as we travel the South, we recognize people who are starved for connections, unable to physically connect. And yet they found a way to broadcast their care in their fellow man and woman by way of their eyes, by way of their hands, by way of this sounds all like, you know, hippy dippy, but their aura, like, you know, they want to connect.
So in that interview with Joe, he brings up the concept of trust in all of this. And somebody wearing a mask is inherently untrustworthy. A smile itself can engender so much trust. So we're living in a time now where I feel like that resource has been almost commoditized. And with everything that's swirling on in the world, tell me how the food and these places that make the food and the people that make the food can help kind of restore that, and why that's so important to your show.
Well, the show focuses on these restaurants as kind of every man and every woman clubhouses where the stratification that comes with class vanishes, where differences grounded in gender or ethnicity or race and racism should vanish. They don't always do, but the possibilities are there. And in a moment like this, so we ended up traveling from Oxford to Brownsville, Tennessee. And our next episode will feature Brownsville, and I don't want to give too many spoilers, but one of the places on which we focus is a fish market, and that fish market, they have kept their prices down throughout the pandemic because they're pulling lake fish from nearby. And talking to the owner, he took such pride in a moment when pork prices were spiking. You remember in the summer, like pork prices were going through the roof. Everybody was worried about Smithfield, which is now owned by a Chinese company, and the control they had over our food system. They're also worried about men and women working in slaughter plants. And so pork prices were skyrocketing. Beef prices were too. And yet, a small town fish market in Tennessee, because they're pulling their fish out of a lake down the road, they recognize their role in that community in a new way. It's to feed good fish, buffalo and cat, to local people, but they also realize that they were an integral part of the food chain and that they were a sure part of the food chain that could not be violated by way of COVID. So there were small moments like that that meant a lot, that we were privy to again and again on the road. People realizing the importance of small and kind of granular connections that restaurants and markets make possible. Mm-hmm. And only in this moment of great tension and fear do we begin to look around and realize the value of those places. And I saw it again and again traveling.
Well, and you say that, and at first glance, you know, you're looking at it and it's, your program is not like anything else that airs on SEC Network. It's mostly about football and basketball, and you don't see the parallel. When you look closer, you mentioned something that's a motif in football in the South, which is that anybody can throw on orange on Saturday and cheer for Tennessee. And that's something that was so big with getting college football back and getting it played this year in these communities that are so afflicted, these college towns. You've been to Athens, you've been to Oxford, you've been to Nashville. On the show, for these people, how big is it to have that college football community kind of intertwined back with it?
Well, it's interesting. You make a great parallel between, you know, college towns. We've focused on a number of them and the import of college football across the whole of the South. I think about, you know, the way we belong to a restaurant, like your favorite restaurant that you and your family might patronize. You belong to that place. You know, when you walk in the door, if you're a regular, if they don't know your name, at least they look up and smile at you. And it says to you, you belong here. We want you here. And, you know, a tribe develops around a restaurant like that. And college football offers the same opportunity to belong, to step out of yourself and into a crowd with which you have some things in common. But if it's the right kind of restaurant, if it's the right kind of team, you have some things in common with people who are a lot different from you. And that's the promise, right? I mean, that's the promise, especially in this divided American moment, mm-hmm. is that football offers us a connecting possibility, and restaurants offer us that too. We connect across all the differences there are. And we really need that right now. I want it bad right now.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and it touches home for me, especially, and I'm sure it does for you, when we think about tailgating. Like, you live in Oxford, Mississippi, and you can't go to the Grove on Saturday now. And that's just gone from Southern Living on these weekends. We've still got the game, but it just is so much different. How has the city of Oxford kind of reacted to this?
Well, I say a small prayer for my friend John Currents, who has five great restaurants here, who in the middle of the pandemic published a book called Tailgate, that is true to its title. It's a great book, but, you know, the marketing opportunities for it shrank in this moment, as you might imagine. But I think you know, what I'm seeing, what happened in Oxford, you know, on the kind of medical level, Oxford embraced masks early. Very early, and we've kept our mask mandate in place. You know, and now with the new spikes, I can't imagine it going away. But So Oxford is often thought of as a bubble in various ways in Mississippi, but it feels like a bubble of sorts. Although, you know, we are also a college town. And as you know very well, you know, college kids, for old people like me, you see a college kid coming, you're like, baby, stay back. But I do see the same kind of communal spirit in Oxford that we lost by way of football. And I see it among my friends and peers who are walking the square with masks on for exercise. I see it now as restaurants have developed outdoor spaces. I don't know how long that's going to sustain them. People are looking for replacements. And, you know, one thing that is sustained is everybody on the street looks up and talks now. I mean, that's been pretty common in Oxford, but it's even more so now. People, even if they're just going out to walk their dog, they want to see another human. And, you know, sometimes we go walking with our cocktails in hand. All the time we go walking with cocktails. So it becomes a walking cocktail party wherein you don't pause for long, but you do get a chance to see people and connect with people. It doesn't add up to the Grove. Nothing adds up to the Grove. I mean, nothing adds up just to the scene in Oxford on a Saturday downtown with people milling through, you know, and everybody intersecting that one small plot of land, which is what we want, but proximity is not our friend right now.
Yeah, and that's made everything about this season so weird. And yeah. You think about these college towns, whether it's Auburn or Tuscaloosa, and these institutions, these eateries that have made those towns what they are, and they sometimes will be a hole in the wall, sometimes it'll be on the second story of a building in the square in Oxford. But can I ask you just how can you emphasize how important it is for people to get out and support these businesses right now? Because if they go away, they're not coming back.
Yeah, I think about in the first season of the show, we focused on Scott's Barbecue in a little community called Norwood on the fringe of Athens. And, you know, that husband and wife, it began as a second job for both of them. And then as they began to head towards retirement, it became something more. And, you know, they have raise their family in that business, their son and now their grandson. And that business has become a hub for the whole of that community of Norwood. It's now also the place, and some of this business has been gained by way of the SEC network, I'm happy to say. It's now the place, too, when people come in for a Georgia game, more and more people will stop there to get her collard greens, his ribs, this beautiful food. And families are, you know, building their trips around that. So, I mean, you know what this is like. You build your trip around this thing in four football games in a row. You stop there. It becomes a part of your identity. It becomes a part of how you, you know, how you regard Athens, Georgia in the year 2020. And, you know, and then the next year you do it. And then as you grow older, you think, well, I'll bring my son here when we do that. So it is both emotionally important, but it's also in a deep and profound way, it is financially important to those small businesses. I mean, you know, in college towns across the South, we see, you know, bungalow homes being replaced by the real estate investment trust condos, and that's smart investment, some of the best returns you can get. We also see, you know, small town barbecue joints like the Scott's being replaced by chains like Moe's. Moe's started out of Tuscaloosa, and they do a pretty good job, but the fabric of the community is lost emotionally. And so is the ability of a family to build generational wealth. As, you know, the father builds a business, hands it off to the son, next son picks it up. Like, all those pieces of the puzzle are so important, and they're deeply important in college towns where the economy is so much dominated by the college that we need the lifeblood of that creativity and entrepreneurship to distinguish the college town. Because if we end up with dominant industry being the university, which is a real big corporation when it all comes down to it, a corporation that does much good, but it's still a big, you know, a big presence. And then we end up with chains, then we lose the distinctiveness that makes college towns, you know, the kind of beacons that they are in the South. And we need that, and we want that. I want that.
Yeah, I can't say I disagree.
Sorry, I'm sermonizing, man.
No, that's why we brought you on. And you can hear more of that excellent insight on True South. The show's out now, streaming on ESPN. First episode's out of the third season, rolling along. John T., thank you for joining the program today. Be well, my friend.
Thank you, sir.
All right, that was John T. Edge. I did want to say a little thing about the show, just one last sell. You know, from a pragmatist view, food is simply about sustenance. But I feel kind of like anybody with a soul knows a little bit better. So much about food's importance is not necessarily just as simple as nourishment. John T. said it himself in that first episode, but it's this common ground that we so badly need right now. A postage stamp, as Wright Thompson described it, in which we can all stand on. Folks may not agree on who should be the president of this country, but generally, people in consensus are not turning down a good meal. For someone who has not watched the show before, it is not exactly just another food travel show. It's about the people who make the food and why they make the food and the people who eat the food and the community that that fosters. That's us. That's the South. It's about that connection. It's about right here. In a soliloquy over some B-roll in this first episode from Oxford, John T. describes it as this, quote, "To be a regular at a restaurant is to pledge yourself to that place, to embrace its beauty and its flaws. Out of that pledge comes fierce loyalty. We protect that place we claim. When they get threatened, we get scared because we know what's at stake." Does that not sound like why you chant "War Damn Eagle" and "Roll Tide"? Why people get so upset when a 22-year-old throws a ball made from a pigskin to a guy in the wrong color jersey? Does that not sound like why it matters just a little bit more down here? I feel like so often we get tied up in whether or not Tennessee won or lost and what Jim Chaney called on 3rd and 7 and so on, forget why we cared in the first place about the University of Tennessee or Alabama or Florida or Ole Miss. But it really does, at its base level, give us something to be a part of. And as obvious as that may sound, it is true. And that's what food does. It brings us together. It's our collective tapestry. For better or for worse, in this part of the country, you think about all the influences from people in bondage, slaves, and what they brought to the cuisine of this region. It tells the story of this place, and that is what this show is about, and how that has transformed into the people of this region now in 2020 even. It's got gravity, and I'm not going to stand in front of the fact that most people tuning into SEC Network want to watch Paul Feinbaum, and Paul Feinbaum does a fantastic job, and this isn't that. All I'm saying is that it's probably worth your time. Third season's out now. New episodes dropping every month. First episode from Oxford is available. That came out October 22nd. The first two seasons are also available for stream on ESPN+. When we come back, we'll do some SEC superlatives. Talk about Lane Kiffin. Talk about Mike Leach. Also, some breaking news. Trevor Lawrence, the best player in college football, has tested positive for COVID-19, so we'll talk about that and the impact that it has on Clemson as they gear up for a game against a scrappy Boston College team and the implications it could have down the line on the college football playoff. This is Run It Up, WKGM Fox Sports Knoxville. We'll be back in a moment. This is Run It Up. We've got a bit of breaking news about Trevor Lawrence and a spirited discussion about what it means, why maybe this is the first time we've really seen COVID have long-lasting impact on who might and might not play for a college football playoff, because I think it was inevitable, but this is the first time I think we're really seeing it. But before that, must remind you that we are broadcasting from the White Claw Hard Seltzer Studios at Fox Sports Knoxville, and White Claw Hard Seltzer is crafted using seltzer water, 5% alcohol, and a hint of fruit flavor. Only 100 calories, and now available in 8 refreshing flavors, including fresh watermelon, sweet tangerine, and juicy lemon, each one a wave of pure refreshment. White Claw Hard Seltzer, made pure. Please drink responsibly. Okay, so this is the breaking news. I wanted to wait for a second. It broke right as we were coming on air. Wanted to take some time to confirm it, make sure it was true. Trevor Lawrence, presumed number one overall draft pick and starting quarterback for the Clemson Tigers, has tested positive for COVID-19. Justin, we've seen this across college football. I don't think we've seen a name of this caliber be impacted by it. There was Nick Saban. He ended up being negative with a false positive, but now this one kind of hits home in a big way.
And you haven't had a bigger name. I mean, you're talking about a guy that's, to this point, your probable Heisman Trophy winner, right?
I'd say so.
And a future probably number one overall draft pick. So, no, sure. I mean, you haven't had any name like this, but, I mean, you couldn't predict that Trevor Lawrence was going to be the one, right? But you had to know at some point it was going to happen.
Yeah, and I mean, it has happened. Wisconsin's entire program is shut down for 3 weeks now. There was some information published today by Ross Dellinger of Sports Illustrated, who we will have on tomorrow. He covers college football, about how the cardiac numbers aren't nearly as prevalent with cardiac symptoms post-COVID in the Big Ten, which was a big reason why they decided to hold off. And that's positive news, at least. Trevor Lawrence is a very healthy young man in the prime of his life. So if anybody is suited, as we've seen in mass, to deal with this and not really have ramifications, it's Trevor Lawrence. But it's very unpredictable. And I'm not saying this to fearmonger, but you hear stuff about guys like Rykel Armstead, who is an NFL running back, who has now been hospitalized twice because of COVID-19. And you have to think, okay, he's probably fine. I really hope he's fine. And I'm just going to leave it there. Because people were going to get this, and some people were going to get more sick than others. And we accepted that as soon as we decided we were going to play sports, not in a bubble. I'm just going to continue to hammer that point home. And that's okay. At a certain point, you can't shell up anymore. At a certain point, you have to return to life and assess the risk at your own risk, at your own peril. I don't think Trevor Lawrence regrets playing football this year. He may have gotten COVID if he decided not to.
Yeah.
But as this may sound callous, but I think obviously it's said that we hope Trevor Lawrence is okay. That goes without saying. The interesting part from the sports perspective of this is, okay, well, what if Clemson now loses to Boston College? What does that mean? How is that assessed? What if he misses 2 weeks and they lose two in a row? Is it wrong to ask those questions? Check me if I'm
no.
out of bounds.
But I mean, realistically, I don't think, especially if he just misses the 1 week, this is still a Clemson team that should probably handle Boston College, right?
Sure. I'm just postulating, but what if they don't?
No. But I think that definitely gets taken into account for college football playoff aspects, right?
One would think, but I don't know. We've talked about undefeated Pac-12 teams, and I'm not trying to be opportunistic here in this hypothetical situation, and I am looking up Clemson's schedule to figure out who the next couple of teams are. So It's Boston College this week. Guess who they play next week? Notre Dame.
Yeah.
In South Bend. So that's a top four matchup. And if you're Clemson, you're a lot more worried about that. Now, Clemson's recruited the position well. I'm not going to try and say the guy's last name, but the number one overall quarterback from last year, DJ something behind Bryce Edwards, he is going to step in. He's the next guy at Clemson, and they'll probably be fine. It's just like, okay, what if Clemson loses to Boston College, who's been scrappy this year, has been a tough out, then loses in South Bend next week against Notre Dame? They've got two losses, and they're without Trevor Lawrence, granted. And Trevor Lawrence comes back, and they're Clemson again. But what if a team from the Pac-12 goes undefeated? How do you tell them that they're not getting in over a two-loss Clemson team?
Well, I mean, in this hypothetical, right, assuming Lawrence comes back, right, let's say worst-case scenario, they drop both these games.
Clemson, which is not necessarily unfeasible.
Clemson wins out, goes to an ACC title game against Notre Dame
and
with
wins.
Trevor Lawrence, beats Notre Dame. I still think Clemson's in.
Yeah, I agree. And I don't know if we're going to
get to
this
doomsday. I know that's really specific to this hypothetical.
It's not unlikely. But it's not unlikely. It's not unlikely. And if they are without Lawrence here for a couple of weeks, because, I mean, that's the presumed carrier time. Now, I assume that if he is able to be symptom-free with my limited medical knowledge, and that should be an adequate disclaimer to say I don't know what I'm talking about, but I'm trying. If he misses this week, he probably would be ready to go for Notre Dame. I don't know where he would be at physically.
Probably.
But one would think that he would be cleared to play in that Notre Dame game if this goes how it's gone for the vast majority of people in his age demo with his level of physical fitness. So I don't know how much this really matters. Every team is going to get at least one hiccup, especially if your best player is not playing against Boston College.
Yeah.
And by the way, I also think they're going to be fine. Boston College may be a tough out, but they're also at home and they still have Travis Etienne, right?
Oh, they should still beat Boston College by multiple scores.
I wouldn't be surprised if it's a little bit closer, but they are talented at the position. They stuck a punter in at quarterback against Georgia Tech and still were able to complete passes just for fun. So I think they're going to be fine. It's just a developing story, and really the first time this has hit home in a significant way. There was a flirtation with potential ramifications for the college football playoff when Nick Saban contracted the virus, and then it turned out he hadn't contracted the virus and was able to coach in that big game against Georgia. But this is the first time we're really getting to see this play out and see what it might do long-term with ramifications, and that fascinates me. Again, maybe that's callous, but I am interested to see what happens down the road. And does this disqualify Trevor Lawrence from Heisman discussions because his numbers aren't going to be as gaudy?
No, I don't think so.
You don't? So that's the other thing. Are we just throwing out total statistics and going to per-game averages and moments?
Even if Trevor Lawrence loses two games, who are your other best challengers for the Heisman?
Mac
Jones at Alabama.
Who's going to put up, at this trajectory, numbers that rival that of Joe Burrow?
And Justin Fields at Ohio State.
And Najee Harris.
And Fields is already only playing, what, eight games? Seven games?
We'll play nine with the conference title.
Yeah. So, I mean, he's already losing games on everybody else, but I still think he has as much of a shot as either of the other two. Assuming Mac Jones sustains this level of play.
Which there's no reason to assume he wouldn't.
Yeah. But, I mean, no, I don't think Trevor Lawrence has been talked about as a Heisman candidate for 3 years now. I don't think that two games necessarily takes him out, especially in a weird season like this, whenever it's not really under his control.
Yeah, I think this is going to be the exemplifier of reputation meaning a little bit more this year.
Yeah, and it does. I mean, that's just the way it is. I mean, it means a lot every year, but especially whenever you're not getting to see people outside of conferences play games, your name and your brand carries significantly more weight than it usually does, and it usually carries a pretty good amount anyway.
Well, the other thing is, for Notre Dame, this opens, again, as bleak as this sounds, because you're taking advantage of somebody else's bad health, but if he's not able to go for that game, that's a massive opening for them, because I don't pick them at all with any chance against Clemson if Trevor Lawrence is playing, but at home against Clemson, yeah, now I do, and if they were on the table and only had the one loss in the conference title to a presumably healthy Clemson, they're getting into the playoff. And I don't think they would have with two losses to Clemson.
Yeah.
And that's just, that's assuming that they are able to win the rest of their games, which they may not. But fascinating nonetheless. Fascinating nonetheless. We'll get into some SEC superlatives, but figured that was an important story to cover here on the eve, before the eve of Clemson's next football game. That's the other thing. They don't get much time to prepare a new quarterback to be the starter. So good thing they've been blowing people out so that their quarterbacks can play.
That is a positive of being a very good team.
Generally, that you're good at football, yeah. Helps you win football games, you know, in short. Run It Up will return. WKGN Fox Sports Knoxville Fan Run Radio. Run It Up. We're going to play a game to finish. This is like your yearbook, except with people in the SEC, the conference where it just means more. It's SEC superlatives. Dun, 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 dun.
You think Lane Kiffin would sign my yearbook?
Yeah, I do. I do.
But somehow with a penny. Or somehow in the most annoying way possible.
Yeah,
he'd do it with like a neon green pen all over the entire page.
He'd sign it, but like with one of those phonemes that mean something dirty.
Joey Freshwater?
Yes. I don't know what that's a reference to. Am I a bad
that
person?
That was his name he used whenever he'd go to clubs in Knoxville when he was the coach.
Oh, okay.
That was his alias. You yes. really don't get that reference?
No, man.
Wow.
I live in the now. Life in the fast lane, baby. So, the first one here is the most likely to pay a fine in pennies. Speaking of Lane Kiffin, I don't know if that's ever been an actual superlative, but I wanted an opportunity to work this in. The man is trying to pay an SEC fine of $25,000 in pennies.
Which is a baller move, by the way.
It is, and he's going to be able to do it. This is the best bar promotion of all time.
Can he? I thought that the SEC just took, like, every fine that went to a school out of their revenue share at the end of the year.
Yes, absolutely. That's
exactly
what's going to happen.
You don't actually ever end up giving them money.
But he is going to be able to accrue $25,000 in pennies. I don't doubt that.
That's a lot of pennies.
That is. It's $2.5 million.
Yeah. He also didn't get the math right for like the first three times he tweeted it the other day. But
no.
That's relatable.
Yeah. Hashtag math is hard. So, a ton of bars in college towns, specifically in Oxford, but really in a lot of SEC towns, are doing this where they're asking people to leave a couple pennies for Lane Kiffin. It's just like that, I was going to make a joke about Hugh Freeze in that one bar. If you know the story I'm talking about, you know the story I'm talking about. I'm not going to stoop to that level. And you shouldn't either, Justin. I know you're ready to.
I actually don't know that I know this one off rip, but keep
okay,
going.
Okay, I'll tell you off air. So, I do want to talk about the broader thing that this is about with Lane Kiffin. This is not my idea. The idea was actually brought to my attention by College Game Day a couple weeks ago, but this is what's so brilliant about Lane Kiffin. He did this at Tennessee. When his team isn't that good, and by the way, if you weren't paying attention, this upcoming juggernaut that Ole Miss was after they came close to beating Alabama, has not won a football game since week two at Kentucky. It's been rough, even if Auburn may have won the game under dubious circumstances.
Yeah, the best part about this is that Kiffin's actually right. Like,
yeah,
has 1,000% a reason to be upset. The SEC fumbled that one. Haha, see what I did there?
Yes, exactly. Fumbled the bag. All of that aside, Lane Kiffin is so good at making stuff up like this to draw attention away from his football team so they're not under fire. They're not under scrutiny. There's not added pressure from the fans or the media on his teams. And maybe I'm giving him too much credit for this, maybe not. So that he can work on the problems without that extra level of scrutiny. Which would be a masterstroke if that's actually his intention. I can't tell if he is just really excited about getting people's attention, which may be part of it, but I think that part may have mellowed a little bit in his older age. He is the best Twitter follow in college football, and he is definitely winning the Egg Bowl battle right now between him and Mike Leach.
Without a doubt.
Because Mike Leach is just kind of detestable right now. We'll
get
to
that. Not great.
We'll get to that. We'll get to that. He said he wouldn't be surprised after four players left the program this week if there were a lot more, quote-unquote, defectors must be purged, quote-unquote.
Bring your brooms. It's a mess, Peyton.
Indeed, on the pirate ship, on the poop deck. Yeah, onomatopoeia. Heyo. Okay, so moving on. I'm going to open this one up to the room. Most likely to drop his or her phone in the toilet. I think this one is...
Is this a reference to something that I'm not picking up on that's happening?
No, it's just a receiver who drops footballs.
Oh.
Anybody in particular? I'll be honest, I just threw this on the rundown thinking it would be fun, and then I couldn't think of a receiver.
Yeah, I don't have one right now. Can I do an ante one of these?
Yeah, sure.
Like, least likely to drop phone in the toilet? Kyle Pitts.
Kyle Pitts, good.
Down at Florida. More Ole Miss.
You know who else isn't going to drop their phone in the toilet? Shai Smith.
Yeah.
Devontae Smith. George Pickens. Josh Palmer. I'll put him up there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Moving on. Most likely to be fired midseason.
We going head coaches or coordinators here?
Anybody.
I'll give you one of each.
Okay.
Head coach, Muschamp. Right.
Okay.
Is that fair?
That would not have been the first place I went.
Where would you go? Which head coach do you think is most likely to get fired?
As much as I love Derek Mason, it's not been good.
Oh, yeah, it's bad. But, like,
he's the most inspiring. He wins that superlative as well. I'd run through a brick wall for that dude.
But, like, who are you going to get?
I don't know. It's just not been very good, and there's a new athletic department. Muschamp, that's not a bad shout. Give me the coordinator.
Probably Bo Pelini, the guy we talked about last week.
Yeah.
He looked better.
That's where I was going. What about Chaney? If it gets really bad for Tennessee against Arkansas, like they put up 9 points, do you fire Chaney? As I love Jim Chaney, and I think he's a good coordinator, but it's just flatly not working right now. For, like, T. Martin, who has called plays in the past successfully.
I don't remember any of T. Martin's offenses at USC being particularly good.
I don't think he
was never the full-time coordinator
He was a co-play coordinator.
He was like a passing game coordinator.
Passing game co-OC. Coordinator. Yeah.
No, I don't think that happens, and I don't think it should happen. I say what you will about Chaney's offense this year, but there's a lot of other factors happening there. You can blame it on COVID. You can blame it on being hindered by a quarterback. You can blame it on being hindered by Jeremy Pruitt. But I think the fact of the matter is, and that's been proven over his entire body of work as a coordinator, is that Jim Chaney is a very good OC, and I don't think there's any reason to fire him. I mean, I don't think Chaney leaves unless Pruitt were to somehow get fired. You clean the entire staff out. I think they're kind of tied together, unless Chaney decides to leave at some point on his own accord.
Okay, fair enough. I'm going to say Mike Leach. Manz is not making it out of the year.
There's no way.
You really don't think so?
That would be wild, though.
It's pretty bad. I mean, okay, here's the article. Mike Leach confirms 3 Mississippi State players leave team, believes running back Kylan Hill also among departures. So you've chased off the best player on the football team.
Really?
Yeah.
He transferred?
They're saying he's going to leave, according to the CBS Sports article written by David Cobb on October 28th. The exact quote was that they were going to, quote, purge all of the, quote, malcontents.
I can see Hill being upset. I mean, you're a running back in a Mike Leach offense. You didn't sign up for that exactly.
Yeah,
but still, he's by far their most talented offensive player.
Well, it's the fact that it's not just Kylan Hill. It's mass exodus. Like, he said he wouldn't be surprised if 14 or 15 players left the program.
That's
with
tough.
Several others in the preseason. I get it if you just don't want to play in a Mike Leach offense. It's not what optimizes your skill set. It's not what's going to help you get to the NFL. That makes sense, but the guy is just abrasive. And when it's winning, it's great. When it's going well, it's going well.
I mean, he's certainly an acquired taste.
But when it's bad, this is what happens. And in the SEC, there are a lot more expectations than there were at Washington State. I'm sorry. This offense that's supposed to be the bread and butter of this team went 20 drives without scoring a point. Like, this is bad. Apparently in the Kentucky game, he didn't call plays. He just said, go run to space. As they threw, like, four picks or whatever it was.
It's not good.
It's not. I also have down here, most likely not to change at all. I also think that's Mike Leach.
Okay.
What say you guys?
I'd have to stick with the Jim Chaney one. I mean, I don't...
You don't think it's getting better?
Okay, most likely not to change... Oh, overall. Give me a minute.
Okay, sure. Spin your wheels. I'll talk. Actually, maybe I won't.
You don't think Mike Leach changes his attitude at all?
No!
I don't think he does either.
He's not changed at all after he put a guy in a closet and got fired for it.
I'm almost tempted to say, like, Jeremy Pruitt, just in the way he does things and thinks about things. I don't think that guy's changing at all. For better or for worse, like...
That's who you got.
Like, I think Pruitt is who he is, and I think that's what you love the most about him, and that's what can be the most frustrating at times. Like, I don't think he changes anything about the way he does anything.
Okay. Will agrees.
Yeah, I agree.
One thing here. I do just want to share this Mike Leach fact from the Pac-12. Hashtag back the pack. Hashtag Pac-12 after dark after this week. The man walked to work. 6 miles. Every day. 6 miles back. Every day. In Pullman, Washington. Just kind of a guy. He's hard to understand. But he ain't changing anytime soon. That's the show today. We back tomorrow. Run it back tomorrow. That's the tagline. Probably should get that in. Got a little bit better today. Bye-bye, everybody.